I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to The Connection. Have you talked to any strangers in the last few days? Maybe you were in line at the grocery store or grabbing a cup of coffee or on the bus or train going to work when you exchanged a few words with someone you'd never met before. These seemingly small moments of human interaction can have oversized benefits when it comes to our mental and even our physical health. So why do we hold back instead of striking up a conversation? We don't know what to say or how to do small talk. We worry that we might be bothering them. We're afraid they'll reject us or we'll get pulled into something we might regret. Our guests, researchers Jillian Sandstrom and Erica Boothby, have found that we underestimate our ability to engage with people we do not know. We're probably better at it than we think, and they're probably more receptive than we presume. So today on The Connection, how to talk to strangers. Jillian Sandstrom is associate professor in the psychology of kindness at the University of Sussex. She's the author of a brand new book called Once Upon a Stranger. It's about the science of small talk. And Jillian Sandstrom, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Erica Boothby here in our Philadelphia studios is a social psychologist at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies social connection. And Erica Boothby, nice to have you with us on The Connection as well.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And I should say to our listeners, they have collaborated on some of the research which we will be talking about today. Jillian, let me begin with you and begin with, I guess we can call it the cupcake incident on the subway in Toronto. You're sitting across from a woman who's holding this spectacular cupcake. What did you do and how did this open up this whole world of talking to strangers to you?
Yeah, it was, I had been out for lunch and I was with a friend that I didn't see very often. And so I was kind of buzzing and I saw this woman with this beautiful cupcake and I thought I must know where she got this cupcake. And I think the reason it was so transformative for me is I don't remember, you can't avoid talking to people, right? I mean, I obviously talked to strangers before that day, but I don't remember ever just choosing to talk to someone that I didn't have to talk to. And so I just I talked to her about the cupcake and the conversation did what conversations do. It, you know, bounced around. And by the end of the conversation, we had somehow gotten from cupcakes to ostriches. And this woman had taught me that people can ride ostriches, not saying that people should ride ostriches. But
right.
So it was just, it was really delightful. And it sort of made me think if that could come from a simple conversation, what might I be missing out on? And it made me start talking to people a bit more often.
You describe yourself as an introvert, as someone who doesn't
Absolutely.
Necessarily, you know, love big social gatherings, really prefers probably being home and reading a book with your cat and a cup of tea.
Exactly.
But you also say that talking to strangers suits introverts. And I was so curious why.
Yeah, I think, so I usually refer to it in terms of being on the tube, but the subway in Toronto is a good place to say this as well. Like, that's a situation that as an introvert, I find a bit overwhelming, you know, because it's noisy, it's crowded, it's hot. And I think just turning to the person sitting next to me and having a chat is a way of kind of coping with all that. I can just zoom in on that person and focus on them and sort of shut out all the chaos around me. So I find it a really helpful thing to do.
How about for you, Erica? Are you someone that strikes up a conversation with a stranger on a subway?
Well, I would say similarly to Jillian, it wasn't necessarily always my natural tendency. But as I've researched this and learned more, I have been more inclined to do it than ever in the past.
Why? Why?
Well, I've learned that it usually our fears are misguided. So we are afraid of all kinds of things. Actually, Jillian's done a great job cataloging all of our various fears, and there are many, and they are very common. And so reminding myself that I'm not the only one feeling this way, everyone else is feeling this way too, and is therefore inhibited from starting a conversation with me, that helps me to get started. And I think there's ways to dive in that are a little less scary. Like in my own research, I've looked at compliments.
Right.
So just complimenting a stranger as a, you know, initial kind of foray into the conversation, much like with, you know, Jillian thinking about a cupcake, you know, I'm sure she was like, that's an amazing cupcake, you know, and that just sort of starts you off with a little bit of positivity to kind of, you know, fuel the fire.
So what are you afraid of? I mean, in starting a conversation with someone you might know or thinking about it, What are the things that are going on in your head?
I think the biggest one is just the fear that they don't want to talk to me.
Right.
That they prefer to be doing whatever they're doing, scrolling on their phone, gazing out the window. Am I interrupting them? And am I interfering with their day? That sort of thing.
And Jillian, I mean, that, I think we can all relate to something that you just said there. But I wonder, Jillian, what are the other things that hold us back? And I'm thinking, I don't know if it's true in England where you are, but we have a kind of stranger danger here, which is don't talk to strangers because they're strangers. They might be strange. They might pull you into something you do not want to be a part of. What holds us back?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think, you know, we've all been taught since we were a young age about stranger danger and that we shouldn't talk to people. But I think, so like Erica said, I think rejection is the thing that I assumed would be people's biggest worry. But actually, I think people are more worried about awkward silences. They're more worried that if they did start talking, you can't possibly predict what will happen, right? Because you don't know this person, you don't know what they're interested in, what they know about. It's impossible to know. And so there's this uncertainty, which is both unsettling, but also kind of exciting if you can figure out how to look at it that way instead. But I think it's the worry that the conversation might be boring or it's going to be awkward. And basically, I think that boils down to the feeling that we don't know how to do this.
And we don't because we have all these ideas about that other person that prevents us from interacting?
I mean, I think we worry about the other person's judgment, but we also worry about our own skills. And Erica has done some great work on that that you might want to ask her about.
I'll let you do the interview for me, Jillian. Fair enough. A handoff to you. I mean, we're talking about small talk, are we not, Erica?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, And Jill and I have some work showing, you know, that people are worried about starting a conversation, worried about keeping it going. Are they going to find common ground? And I think that is a big one. But what we forget is that when we enter into a conversation with someone else, we're both like magnets searching for common ground, you know, and I think we discount the extent to which that's true once we enter into the conversation. We're not going to be the only ones trying to keep it going.
Right.
The other person is too, right? And we're both working on that together in various ways.
There's a thing called that you call collaborative riffing, which is different from saying, where are you from? What do you do? Do you have a family?
Yes.
You know, all those sort of, how's the weather today? Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Give me an example of collaborative riffing.
Yeah. So this is basically within a topic we call shared reality. So it's like, how do you kind of come together and see the world the same way and start to align your minds, right? And be able to anticipate what the other person's going to say, right? This is a big part of kind of that the bump and grind of talking to a stranger where right. You don't know what they're going to say next. You don't know how they think. You don't know how they approach things. And so if you can start to do that kind of from scratch with someone and feel that out, it can be, you know, really powerful. And it can just be something as simple as, you know, commenting on an observation, right?
That you're both observing, right?
Maybe you've noticed something and you can comment on that or how it makes you feel. Like in our studies, in one study I ran with my collaborator, Maya Rossignac-Milan, we showed people a kind of ambiguous image. So it was a bar scene. It was, you know, someone sitting at a bar, kind of leaning on it. There are a couple people talking, but it's a line drawing. There's a lot you could kind of fill in the blanks with. It's not really clear
what's
happening.
Kind of a Rorschach in a way.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, yes. And we just prompted people to talk about it and figure out what's going on, right? And that's a way you can kind of think about how you can apply that, you know, in your everyday life. So you're kind of noticing something, what's going on there, how are you making sense of it? And the more people talked and chatted in that conversation, the more they aligned their minds and the more they felt a sense of connection with the other person.
Jillian, people like to talk about themselves. So asking questions, I mean, that seems sort of obvious. It's what journalists do. They go to a strange country or a strange town to do some reporting and they ask why and who and where and when and how. Does that also apply to us regular folks or regular folks?
Yeah, I've So when I started writing this book, I reflected on all these conversations that I've been keeping track of over the years, and thought about what are the ways that I've used to start conversations? Because people are always saying, how do you get started? I want some tips. And I think it kind of boils down to three different themes, and they spell the word quick. So we've got QU, which stands for a question, which is what you just asked about, and then IC, which is something in common, which just you just brought up, and then kindness, which also came up when Erica was talking about compliments. But I think questions is an easy one, and I think it just allows us to tap into our curiosity. Giving you permission to just be kind of curious and wonder about other people. And I think a lot of us do that, right? There's, a lot of us like to peer in the window on the street when the lights are out and say,
Oh,
"Ooh,
indeed.
let's look at those bookshelves and
Absolutely.
what a great paint color." So I think we have this kind of natural interest in other people. And if we start to pay attention, the questions come to mind really easily. So I'll notice someone. I like walking, so I'll notice someone with a pair of binoculars and I'll say, "Oh, what are you hoping to see today, or what have you already seen today?" Or I'll notice someone wearing, once I was on the subway and I saw multiple people wearing the same t-shirt because they were participating in some kind of race, and so I was asking them about the race. And I think there's a million questions. Why are you standing in that queue? What is everybody waiting for? And I think it's a great way to start a conversation. And they understand why you're talking to them, which is really helpful. You get past the sort of confusion or concern.
Well, I wanted to raise that because not every stranger wants to talk to us. So how do you, and maybe Eric, I can toss this back to you. How do you sort of read the situation and know maybe where the boundaries are, or do they really want to have a conversation with me?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think the thing to keep in mind is that our threshold tends to be off, right? It's too high. And so we're set at a point where we have we won't pass it until we're like very certain that someone else really does want to talk to us. But I think the thing we can do, kind of like what Jillian said, is, we can lob out a possibility, right? "Oh, what are you hoping to see today?" through the binoculars. And if they respond in a really curt, kind of shut it down way, then you say, "Cool, I hope you see that. I hope it goes well." And you move on, right? And if they seem like they want to engage, then you engage. And I think part of it is having a little bit of a thicker skin, knowing that even if they, are not up for a conversation in that moment, maybe they're hyper-focused, it usually has very little to do with you and more to do with them and what they're doing and what they're focused on in that moment.
Which is why it's important to pay attention, right? To be able to read the moment, to know sort of, okay, this feels like an opening, or maybe not.
Exactly.
Well, I'll
But
tell you
sometimes
what.
it changes. Sometimes it changes. I have a favorite story of mine. I was on the tube. Oh, are you wanting me to pause?
Oh, yeah, I am actually.
I
You're very good at reading a
was like
situation, Jillian.
reading
I'm
your
just
body
saying.
language.
We are going to take a very short break, but we'll pick up on your story after this short break. And we're talking with Jillian Sandstrom, and she is a psychologist of kindness. She's also the author of a new book, Once Upon a Stranger. Also with us is Erica Boothby. She's a social psychologist at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies social connection. And we are talking today on the show about talking to strangers. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and we're talking about what you need to know about the science of small talk and also the benefits of talking to strangers. And again, our guests are Jillian Sandstrom and Erica Boothby. Jillian, let's hear your story.
I left you in
You
suspense. I did
did.
your
We're
job
hanging
for
on.
you.
Yeah, go for it.
So I was saying, sometimes it might seem at first like people don't want to talk, and I think that's probably quite normal because the truth is that there isn't, we don't talk to strangers all that often, and so it's unexpected. And so I think, like Erica said earlier, you had to have a bit of a thick skin and realize that at first people might be a bit confused or concerned, like, "Do I know you? Oh, I don't know you. What is happening? Are you trying to sell me something, or are you trying to hit on me?" So they have to make sense of what's going on. And I think most of the time that does happen, and people get to a point where they realize, oh, you're just being friendly, great. And then you can have a really nice conversation. So one of my favorite stories about talking to stranger, I was on the subway in London, and I had had a very exciting morning. And so I was kind of buzzing, and I talked to a woman and I said, you know, how's your morning been? And she did that thing where she just politely said, yeah, it's fine, thanks. And that was it. And I thought, okay, I guess this conversation is over. And then I think my guess is what happened is she realized, I need to be polite. And so I should ask this stranger, you know, how her morning has gone. And so she asked me and I told her about, you know, the exciting thing I've been doing that morning. And then I think because I opened up to her, she opened up to me. You know, we know that that's how it works. Self-disclosure, you know, you do it, someone else returns the favor. And she told me that she had just been at the doctor and she just found out that she was pregnant. And it was such a special moment because I knew she'd be going back to work and not really able to talk about it because, you know, you wait and make sure everything's going okay. But it was safe to tell me because I don't know her. I don't know anyone she knows. And it was a really, really touching, special moment. We shared a hug on the tube.
You know, which raises the interesting question about why we might tell a stranger something we might not tell a friend. And I know you have some thoughts about this, Jillian, but I'm curious, Erica, if you have some thoughts as well about why we maybe feel empowered in a way to tell someone we have never met something that might be very intimate and personal.
Yeah, I think of this kind of as like the vacation effect.
Right, right.
You know, if you're out of your normal orbit and people don't know one another, again, you're out of your network, it can feel a lot more comfortable to disclose because there's less risk in a way, right? You're not going to continue that relationship. You know, there's a clear cutoff. And so I think that can feel liberating. And maybe it is a good opportunity for people to get some practice if that, you know, if you feel like you need a sort of a safer space for that.
In fact, Jillian, you say travel is often kind of an impetus for talking to strangers, in part because you need to, because you're lost and you need to find a certain restaurant or a museum that you're looking for. So, you know, you're more proactive, I think, when you're traveling in a foreign place.
Yeah, it's something that's come up over the years that continues to kind of puzzle me is that people seem unwilling to talk to a stranger when they're at home, but when they go on vacation, they're very happy to do it. And I think there's lots of reasons for that. I think we're just sort of more open, more relaxed when we're traveling. And like you said, sometimes we need information. We need to know where to go, what to do. And at home, we would just pull out our phone and we sort of feel like we can't ask people. But when we're traveling, we're more willing and more open to do it. And I think there's easy conversation starters. So I think there's a lot of reasons that it's maybe easier for us to do when we travel and people come home with new friends, right?
Indeed. Yeah, go ahead, Erica.
I was going to say, part of it, I think, is that we need an excuse to talk. And
we're lost, right?
Right. Yeah. But I think like we don't need the excuse we think we do, right? It's in our heads a bit. So you know, we think on the other side, people will perceive us, you know, they'll be more accommodating of us. They will actually engage us because we're strangers in a foreign country, right? That they're looking out for us in some way.
But I want to underscore something you said earlier, Erica, about the fact that we really underestimate, I guess, people's interest in having some kind of conversation, people that we do not know. And I think that's such an important issue. I just want to make sure we shine a little spotlight on
that. Like, can we underscore that 1,000 times? Because it is really, really true. It's one of the biggest effects I've seen in social psychology,
really?
I guess, to be frank.
Really?
It is a whopping effect. If you look at people's predictions about how this conversation with a stranger will go, people are anxious, they're nervous, they don't know, they have a lot of fear. It really colors their whole perspective and they expect it to go quite poorly. And everyone is delighted and surprised on the other side, you know, on average, of course, like, you know, maybe that one bad conversation or the thing you didn't, you know, the conversation you didn't know how to kind of pull out of or extract yourself from stands out in our minds. But on average, that's really the rare case. What we find is that people are just feeling so much better after the conversation, in a better mood, more pro-social, right? All kinds of positive benefits.
Jillian, let me go back to you. Tell us about Sid.
Yes.
Sid.
And Sid is related to work that I've done with Erica and Gus Cooney on what we call the liking gap.
Wow.
So it's the idea that we have this voice in our head that's constantly telling us that we are no good at this, that we don't know how to talk to people, that people don't like us. So specifically, the liking gap is this idea, what we found in many, many studies now, is that when two people meet and talk for the first time, we tend to think that we liked the other person more than they liked us.
Wow.
But observers don't see that. So it's clearly something in our heads that we're kind of, we can't read the other person's mind. So we're making up a story. You know, we're saying, oh, shoot, why did I say that? Or, you know, I should have told them this story instead of that one. I decided to name this voice in the head because it feels more concrete that way. And then yes. we can speak to it. And
right. Tell
it to be quiet. Yeah. So Sid, because it's insidious. That's where the name came from.
That makes sense. In fact, Erica, was really and this is how the book begins, where Jillian's book begins, which you're meeting someone, you might be working together with mm-hmm. them, your partner is close by, so he's overhearing your conversation. You walk away with entirely different perspective of what happened yeah. than he did.
Yes.
This is this liking gap, right?
Yes, yes. So I talked to a potential collaborator, we had an initial conversation. I just wasn't convinced by the end that she actually wanted to work together. And I went back and talked to my partner, now husband, Gus, about this. And we just had such different perspectives. We were just like, were we witnessing the same thing? Somehow being on the inside of that conversation felt really different than what he'd observed looking from the outside. And so, yeah, that was one of the things that really prompted us to continue and dig into this.
I mean, question is, did you start collaborating? I mean, were you right or was he right? Or does it matter?
I hate to say he was right, but he was right. We continued the conversation. It didn't end up turning into, you never know where these, collaboration conversations are going to go, but it didn't, it didn't kind of eventually fizzle out for the reasons that I had felt initially.
Jillian, let me go back to you and a story that you told about being upset about something and you're walking through a park and you're, visibly upset, you're crying, and a woman just gave you a look and you exchanged a glance. There was no conversation, but it meant something to you. What happened?
Yeah, it was during COVID, and it's one of those things. I mean, we've all experienced those days where just everything seems awful. And I have no idea what was happening in my mind that day. So it clearly passed, but I was walking around and I was just in that cycle in my head. My head was just spinning faster and faster, full of negativity. And I was barely looking around me. And this woman, she was pushing a baby carriage and she just smiled at me. Mm. And it's not like I was instantly cured, that's not how it works. But it did sort of interrupt. It was just like a kind of a wrench in the cogs, the cogs of my brain. And it just reminded me that, there's other people living their lives and life goes on and everything is going to be okay. It was just a really meaningful thing. And I think a lot of people can name a time where a moment with a stranger really made a huge difference to them.
Because she saw you.
You
existed for her at that moment. She saw
it. It reminded me that the world was bigger than whatever the trouble was in my head at the time. Yeah.
Do you have thoughts on that, Erica?
I mean, I think that it's a good reminder that people are out there and receptive and open to us, and there's warmth out there, and we're just missing out on it a lot of the time, which is the unfortunate thing, because we have the wrong mentality or misguided mentality, right? Too self-protective, too erring on that side of things.
Let me just quickly...
The other thing it reminds me of is the idea that we can be that person for someone else.
Yes, yes. I think that is an empowering message. Ultimately, that's true. We can start it.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you and then I'll pick up on that. And we are talking today about how to talk to strangers, small talk, and noticing others in the world. And again, Jillian Sandstrom is an associate professor in the psychology of kindness, and that's at the University of Sussex, author of a new book called Once Upon a Stranger, The Science of How Small Talk Can Add Up to a Big Life. Also with us, Erica Boothby, and she is a social psychologist at the Wharton School at the University University of Pennsylvania, who studies social connection. And I should add that they have collaborated on some of the research that we will be and have been talking about. Well, let me talk about the fact, and I'll go to you, Erica, about the fact that so many of us, myself included, we're out in the world and we're on our phones. So we are not paying attention to the world around us. We are engaged in the small little world on our phones. So how does that impact how we interact with others, or maybe don't interact with others?
Oh my God, it's so problematic. And I do it myself, right? We're all susceptible to this. And I think I've been doing a little exercise for myself of just trying to not do that, because it really does shut out the rest.
It pulls you in too.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so, you know, if you can put away your phone while you're walking, you know, from the bus stop to your office, or you are more open to the people around you. You're more observing. You're part of it. But the problem is, it's hard when you're the only one and you look around and everyone else is still on their technology. And so I do think it is a tricky thing, but there's evidence that, you know, even having a phone on the table when you're having a conversation with someone else actually degrades the quality of that conversation.
You get pulled in by the...
It's just distracting. Knowing it's there and knowing... It just distracts you because you know what the potential is, you know, if you were to look at it. What are you missing out on? What messages might be coming in, right? It's just distracting, like, period.
We're rats in a maze, I think. Jillian, do you want to weigh in on this about just, were people friendlier to strangers before there was a cell phone? Do we know that or not?
There is some research that has some video footage about 30 years ago, so a span of 30 years, and in a few big cities in the States, and found that people are walking more quickly and spending less time in groups, which kind of makes it seem like we're not in public, at least sort of we're having, you know, that might be some evidence that we're having fewer of these kind of interactions that we could be having. And I think the other issue with the phones kind of stealing our attention is it's just making it so that it's reducing the opportunities that we have to practice talking to people. So, you know, we're working from home, we have automated checkout at the grocery store, we have the phones we can turn to. And I think all that adds up to us talking to people so seldom that it's easy to think we don't know how to do it. And that causes sort of a long-term problem, right?
And there's actually interesting work on social surrogacy, where we basically substitute in other things for actual humans because it's safer. And so we will watch TV, right? You'll have, you know, or YouTube, you know, maybe you follow someone that you like to watch, and you will get kind of your social... coins or whatever you want to hit. Through that. And it feels good in a similar way, but again, like Jillian said, it's not giving us practice to actually do the more truly enriching, you know, having those truly enriching, engaging experiences.
Well, let's talk about the scavenger hunt game. This is a game / research that you both cooked up. And Jillian, yes. I'll toss it back to you. How did you set this up? And then we'll get from Erica what you learned.
Sure. Yeah, this came about from... So when I started doing all this research on talking to strangers, I really wanted to know what were the barriers that were holding people back. And I naively thought I was going to figure out what people were most worried about. I would figure out a way to reduce those particular worries, and then, you know, it would be so much easier and everybody would talk and live happily ever after. But that didn't turn out to work. And I think one of the things that happened is I would try to fix one of the fears. And after having a conversation, people would say, you know, that the conversation went better than they expected and they really enjoyed it. But if I asked them to predict what the next conversation would be like, even though they just had a really pleasant conversation, they kind of wrote that off as an exception. They assumed that the next conversation wouldn't go as well. And so we tend to sort of take all the blame and give all the credit to the other person. And because it's a brand new person, who knows what's going to happen. And so I thought, how do we fix this permanently? You know, how can we improve people's perceptions about talking to strangers in a lasting way? And I think the answer was the easy part. Like, we just need to get people to have a lot of conversations with strangers, and then for sure they'll see that there's this positive pattern. But how are we going to do that? Because people don't even want to have one conversation with a stranger, let alone a series of them. And I was working in a research lab, and there was a sign up on the wall for a cognition study about memory that was kind of a game. And I thought, ooh, we need to have a kind of a game where we get people to, you know, have these different targets that they had to seek out. And so we came up with the idea of a scavenger hunt game where every day people had a list of missions that they could choose from. We wanted people to have some choice. And they were supposed to be easy, right? So it wasn't like, you know, find someone wearing a pink hat. It was, you know, find someone wearing a hat or find someone drinking a coffee, like people that we thought everybody would be able to find. But it helped to just kind of narrow down the options, mm-hmm. and it made it fun for people to play a game in order to do this.
And so what were the findings, Erica? What did you find?
Yes, we ran this over the course of a week, and we found that going in, people thought they'd have to talk to several people in order to find one person who would actually talk to them. Turns out that wasn't the reality, and people did learn that over the course of the week. They expected less rejection by the end. And people also got more comfortable feeling more confident in their ability to start and maintain those conversations, to keep them going.
And not have those nervous-making silences.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. They knew how to get through that. And it gets to the practice kind of doing this repeatedly, right? At least once a day for an entire week, right. Kind of as a pointed exercise that they were doing in this fun way. It seems to have actually made a difference.
So even after the study was over, people continued to interact with strangers?
Yeah, so we actually did a follow-up a week after the conversation, and we saw that the changes that had come about over the course of that week actually did stick.
And Jillian, I mean, does it make us happier if we talk to strangers? Do we actually noticeably and maybe even hormonally feel better?
Yes, that was one of the first studies that I did, and also was a study done by Nick Epley and Juliana Schroeder, who kind of did their work at the same time. We all found that after having a single conversation with a stranger, it tends to put us in a good mood. But I think that, you know, there's a sort of change recently in the conceptualization of what a well-lived life looks like. So there's sort of, we always thought there were two components. There might really be three components. There's this kind of mood and good feelings. There's the sense of purpose. And then there's a sense of richness. And I think talking to strangers gives you all three.
Well, I'll tell you what, another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation about talking to strangers. Much more to discuss after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Do you talk to strangers in the grocery store line, in an elevator, at a sporting event, on a plane or train? Our guests say these fleeting moments of conversation can ease anxiety, can boost self-confidence, and enrich your life. Jillian Sandstrom has a new book. It's called Once Upon a Stranger, The Science of How Small Talk Can Add Up to a Big Life. Our other guest, Erica Boothby, is a social psychologist at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania who studies social connection. Jillian, just picking up on what you were saying right before the break, I mean, do we see dopamine levels or even oxytocin levels connected to talking to strangers? Do we know that?
As far as I know, we don't know that. What we do know on the flip side is the harmful health outcomes when people are lonely, right? So loneliness is associated with negative cardiovascular outcomes like heart disease and stroke and even early mortality. And we think it's because of stress, essentially. It boils mm-hmm. down to stress. So people who are lonely feel more stressed, they're more reactive to stress, they don't have the same buffers, they don't, like, you know, it's people in our lives that help buffer us against stress, and that stress adds up to all these really negative outcomes in terms of our physical health. So presumably having these kind of moments of connection is going to help reduce those that stress related negativity.
Yeah, indeed. Erica, let me go back to you, and even picking up on this collaborative riffing, which you were talking about before, the idea, which is reminds me of jazz, right? Or even improv, which I think is one of the ways that you have described it, or perhaps even Jillian describes it in the book, which is the sort of yes and of conversation. Can you dig into that for us?
Yeah. So it's kind of what comedians do. And improv, I think, is the best example of it. And you can also, you know, watch on YouTube different comedians break this down. Mike Birbiglia does a great job. Like, there are some really good resources. And there's all kinds of workshops that help people talk to strangers that are built on that premise as well. So there's a lot of resources out there if people are curious. But it, you know, it really is just starting with an observation of some kind, right? Digging in and going and running with it. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us, you know, it's really creating your own little world together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think oftentimes the best way to even start that is just by having that little chit chat to kind of break the ice first, right? I think diving straight into that can be abrupt for people if they're not expecting it. So you have to like prime people that they're in this conversation with you. But I think people, it can be kind of a fun lower cost way to engage in a conversation, in part because a lot of the research out there by people Jillian mentioned before, like Nick Epley, is on how we enjoy conversations more than we expect, especially when they are deep conversations, right? When you go deep with the questions instead of sticking with those shallow conversation topics like the weather. But I think for a lot of people, those deep conversation topics, you know,
that can be a little scary.
It can be a little scary. Yeah. And they, in, you know, in the lab, you give people a set of cards and they know what to ask. They kind of know that they're going to be asked some questions. And oftentimes the example they give is, you know, when's the last time you cried in front of someone you didn't know, and you're like, oh my god, but then you actually have that conversation and it goes way better than you think, right? But I do think that can feel a little intimidating, you know, to maybe start off with that. So I like to think of these as just different kind of tools in your arsenal, like different kinds of conversations you can have that we know have great benefits.
I wonder too, Jillian, what kids can teach us. You know, kids, you watch them on a playground, they might not know each other, and kids have this sort of intuitive sense of well, essentially wanting to play together. But I wonder if that can help us adults who are feeling inhibited.
Yeah, I think they're probably braver about voicing their curiosity, right? They're more willing to sort of just ask a question and be brave. I talk about my dad a lot in the book because in my mind, he's like the king of talking to strangers, and he loves nothing more than talking to kids. Kids are his favorite. And it's funny because sometimes it's a little bit hard to get them going because they can be a bit shy. But once you do get them going, they do seem more open and more curious and more willing to sort of play. And maybe it comes back to the riffing that Erica's just been talking about. They're more willing to just kind of be in that moment with you.
Yeah. Your book is a lot about your dad's extroversion and his, mm-hmm. you know, intense ability, I would say, to be able to talk to strangers. So it's interesting that this extrovert has an introvert child.
Yeah, I mean, that's how genetics work sometimes, yeah, right?
Exactly.
I think I always thought my mom was extroverted too, and sort of more recently I've realized actually she's more introverted and I take after her. But I think it really helped me to see my extroverted dad talking to strangers. I didn't understand it. And I think in a way, partly writing this book was my way of trying to understand, you know, help my previous self understand why my dad enjoyed it so much. Why did he keep doing it? And I never saw him get rejected. He'd always make people laugh. You know, we'd be at a restaurant and need an extra chair for the table, and we'd just send dad over to get a chair. You know, it was really useful that he was willing and able to talk to strangers. So I had all these positive, you know, feelings associated with it, but I never thought that I would be the one to do it because I was so shy and anxious. But it still helped to have him modeling that behavior.
I wonder too, and I'm thinking about, and I think we've all gone to a party or some kind of a social gathering where you don't know anybody. And I'm looking at you, Erica. Just be, yeah. And I have been there, done that. And you're just like, where do I start? It's all sort of overwhelming and looking for an entry point, but sort of not knowing anybody. What are your thoughts about that? And then, Jillian, I'll turn to you.
The first thing that comes to mind is I think it's okay to voice that feeling. I think oftentimes we think, okay, I have to, you know, squash those feelings and just like get past it and act normal and act like I'm comfortable. But I think even just voicing the awkwardness and saying, oh, it's funny to be at a party and not know anyone, you know,
say it out loud.
You're not the only one feeling that way.
Right. Yeah. Right. And looking for, I guess, those opportunities to say something like that. I mean, I'm imagining for people, they all know each other. They're laughing, chatting, you know, reconnecting. And there you are, the outsider, the stranger, trying to figure out, well, how do I work my way into
this? I think sometimes being a little more explicit, like, hey, can I sidle up? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like if you just are kind of acknowledging that, I think it kind of puts everyone a little bit at ease, right? You're not pretending to kind of engage or, you know, engaging in a more stilted way. You're actually just being more authentic to how you're actually experiencing the situation. And I think people are quite receptive to that.
What do you think, Jillian?
I mean, that is all great advice. I think what I tend to do is look, I find it harder to join a group of people like you're saying. And so I'll look around the room for someone else that doesn't have someone to talk to. And then I'll tell myself that I'm doing them a favor by going up and talking to them. That's how I trick myself into
Very
it
good.
Sometimes. So I'll look for the one person who also needs someone to talk to and try to start a conversation with them. But the other thing that makes me think of is the group sort of welcoming someone in. So flipping it around, it's a reminder to all of us to keep an eye out for that person who's new and doesn't know anybody and see if we could be the one to sort of bring them in and welcome them.
Be kind, right? Yeah.
It starts with noticing, and that's
noticing.
Hard.
Right.
Because I think people are generally kind, but we maybe don't think of that particular thing being welcoming as being an act of kindness. Absolutely is.
Well, did you want to say something here?
Oh, I was just, yes, I'm nodding in agreement with what Jillian's saying. And I was also just thinking about part of the problem being that we're so caught up in our own worlds, right? And our own concerns about what other people are thinking of us. And so it's a reminder that, you know, just because people aren't acting welcoming in the way that Jillian's saying, which I, you know, in a perfect world, we would all be more like that. But the reason that they aren't appearing that way to us isn't because they don't want to talk to us. It's often because they have their own set of social concerns that they're managing internally, and we just don't have access to that.
Let me up the ante to you, Jillian. Then I'm thinking either a first date or maybe even the first day at a new job, where again, you are the stranger in a place, let's take work, you know, in a place where it's already this functioning machine and you're walking in the door for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing that comes to mind is, I've been thinking about this because of the book. I think the broader message is just, can we be a bit more human with each other, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think in the workplace especially, you know, a lot of us feel like, we wonder about how much we want to reveal about ourselves. You know, there's the professional personal boundary, but maybe what would help is to be able to sort of share a little bit about ourselves, like a little bit of self-disclosure. It doesn't have to be a lot, but just sharing something about yourself so that the other people could see you, not just as a fellow colleague, but like a fellow human, right? And that might help you make that connection that reminds people, you know, that they need to be more welcoming, that you're just another person.
Well, let me dig in on just a little deeper on the psychology of kindness, which is sort of your area of expertise, Jillian, which is, I mean, I think we know where you're going, but give us a maybe a better definition of what that's all about, what that entails.
Yeah, I mean, I think kindness is just the idea of doing something with the intention of benefiting someone else. And I think you know, I took this job at the University of Sussex that was focused on kindness. And at the time I thought, is talking to strangers an act of kindness? It wasn't an obvious connection for me at first. But when I thought about it some more, I thought a couple of things. First of all, it's become clear with data. We've run a big study in the UK between the University of Sussex and BBC Radio 4. We did this giant project called the Kindness Test. We had 60,000 people respond to it. And we asked people about the most recent time that someone had done something kind for them and what that person had done. And so about 10% of the time, the most recent act of kindness had come from a stranger. And it included things like someone smiled at me, someone gave me a compliment, someone stopped and had a chat. So it's really just those tiny moments of connection and feeling seen and, you know, that we've been talking about this whole time. But then I also have come to realize that in order to be kind to other people, especially to be kind to strangers, you need to be able to talk to people. It's hard to be kind without speaking. It's possible, but often if it's a compliment or offering some help or directions or can I help you carry those bags or whatever, often it involves talking. And so I think if we're able to talk to strangers, it opens up the door to be more kind and put more kindness into the world, which we know feels good for us and others as well.
And part of the message is that we probably can do it pretty well. And whoever that stranger is will probably, Erica, not be put off by our comment or our interest in them.
That's right. That's right. That's overblown, that fear. People will respond better and they will also feel better, you know, to Jillian's point about this being a pro-social act in a lot of ways. You know, we will feel better as a result of it and so will the other person.
And I wonder too whether, well, I'm interested because the two of you were strangers and now you're collaborators and I think you're friends. It seems that way. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there are people that you meet once in your life, you have an interaction, you'll never see them again. And then there are strangers who become friends. And I wonder what your story is, Erica.
That's a good question. We actually
you probably have two different stories, just based
we
on
can compare notes.
Yeah, yeah.
It all actually began in a way through the research and us. We both sort of separately stumbled upon some of these interesting patterns and heard about
Didn't know each other was doing it
at the time.
Without
knowing it, and then we somehow got in touch, I believe, through a conference symposium. Jill can correct me on this, We started, you know, talking and saying, oh my gosh, you've seen that in your data? We saw that in our data. We were just both fascinated, curious, and that just honestly sparked the conversation because we had so much to, you know, compare notes on. And then also realizing Jillian's a wonderful, kind, intelligent person that I so much enjoyed talking to, that just, you know, kept up that side of things as well.
A shared interest. And I'm looking at the clock here, Jillian. Let me put something to you because you say also talking to strangers, you can learn things you did not know. I mean, you two have a shared interest, which brought you together. But a lot of times, I mean, a stranger has areas of expertise that are not ours, and it enlarges the sort of world of ideas.
Yeah, and that comes back to the idea of sort of enriching your life. I mean, I have learned so many things. We started this segment by me talking about how I learned that people can ride ostriches. But I think, you know, there's different flavors of that, right? Sometimes it's just hearing a really interesting story. That's a type of learning, isn't it? Sort of learning about different kind of jobs that people can do. You know, I met someone who's a bat first aid, like they deliver first aid to bats, or, you know, I met someone who manages a sperm bank, you know, so you can, it sort of opens your eyes to different ways of living and different perspectives and just makes your life richer.
I almost hate to raise this, but I also feel like sometimes when there's an emergency, like people are all together, something terrible happens, the impulse is, and I think most people, Erica, do this, which is that, you know, you're all on the same page. You want to, you know, help a dog that's in the street, or you want to do something to help somebody else, that there's an event or an incident that gets us connected to each other.
Yes, I think that's definitely true. And it does something that we all, I think, could do more of. It's a good reminder. We don't necessarily need that sort of emergency or incident, but we feel like we do. And I even hear the story from friends who have dogs who like go walk their dog, and that's an excuse to talk to someone.
It is, yeah, because they talk to the dog, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm just talking to the dog, not the stranger.
Yeah.
And we just feel like we need that. But everyone's actually more open than we realize.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Final word to you, 30 seconds, Jillian.
final word to me. Oh, gosh. I wanted to circle back to something you just brought up with Erica about how sometimes when you talk to a stranger, it can turn into a friendship, right? But I wanted to point out something that I think people should think about, which is it's fine if it doesn't,
right?
We don't need every stranger to turn into acquaintance or every acquaintance to turn into a friend. And research is starting to show that there might be different benefits of that. There's benefits to having a diversity of conversation partners, and that there might be unique benefits to talking to different kinds of conversation partners. So don't feel like anything has to come of it. There's something beautiful and human about just having one tiny moment and walking away.
A perfect way to end our conversation. Jillian Sandstrom, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. And again, she's got a new book. It's called Once Upon a Stranger, The Science of How Small Talk Can Add Up to a Big Life. And Erica Boothby, thank you. Thank you for joining us today on the Connection as well.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you both here. Social psychologist at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.